Station number 11944.
Judge Gilland, Reel 7. Whilst you were in England preparing for the invasion, did you personally do any special courses in sniping and patrolling? Because I noticed you say that you were in charge of patrolling.
Yes, I was sent, during that period, I was sent on the sniping course to Llanberis, Llanberis, in North Wales, and we carried out the sniping on the Snowdon, which had been requisitioned at that time, Mount Snowdon. The course was absolutely first class. It was run by the Lovett Scouts from Lord Lovett's private army. They were all gillies. I suppose the instructors, about eight of them altogether. Other non sniping people were administering the organisation. We were a course of officers, and I was there for, I think, about 3 weeks. And during that time, we were not only shown how to use binoculars, telescopes from a sniping point of view, and of course sniper rifles with a telescopic sight. We were also taught the finer points of zeroing a rifle, and of course we were taught a lot of field craft, which I found the most interesting. And the way in which the Lovett Scouts were able to cover an open hillside and get within firing range of us, the spectators, without being spotted by anybody, was absolutely incredible, even though we were using field glasses and so on. They taught us all sorts of tricks, if you like, such as firing through a wall, making a hole in the wall to fire through, not over the top. They also taught us that, for example, you could be just as invisible in front of a tree as behind it, as long as you kept still, reasonably still. And generally taught us about camouflage, movement, and so on, and also indicated how we should train our own staff afterwards. When this course had finished, I went back to the battalion, and a course was arranged for myself in charge for all the snipers in the brigade. They selected, I suppose, half a dozen men from each battalion, and they came, and I passed on the information I'd been given. They were given their 50 times telescopes and all the other equipment which is so necessary for their job, and they paired themselves off, went back to in their own battalions, and their record in the 8th battalion was incredibly good at the beginning, certainly.
Did they always operate in pairs?
Always operated in pairs. That was regarded as being necessary for their own protection, and they were very good, and they were really a permanent patrol. We had them out, and they'd go out for a day or two at a time. They didn't seem to mind being shelled or mortared, because of course in the in-between land they were being liable to be shot from both sides with the heavy artillery and so on. I'm sure they got a lot of kills. They certainly brought a lot of information back, and we found they were very good, and I always feel very satisfied that I passed on the information, or most of the information, the Lovett Scouts had given me. I thought it was a very good move, the snipers. Well, of course, we hadn't had them before in the battalion. We'd never had sniper rifles before.
Did you use them purely for information gathering and reconnaissance?
Oh, no, for shooting people. For shooting people.
They were actually sent out just to gain intelligence, as opposed to...
No, it varied. Obviously, if it's just intelligence, you usually send a patrol out. With these people, they would go out with the intention of killing and generally causing unrest in the enemy positions. And if they happened to pick up information as well, then that was fine. And they were sufficiently intelligent to come back specially if they saw something happening which they thought was worth their coming back for. by and large, they operate entirely on their own and as independent people. And I think probably they've enjoyed not being mixed up with the rest of the hobbledehoy in the battalion.
What sort of targets were they told to go for?
Oh, officers, NCOs. We all knew exactly what the ranks were. One of the reasons that I carried a rifle was that I did not want to be distinguished necessarily from an enemy's point of view as an officer, because once you've done that sort of course, is that you realise that these ranks are easy to spot if you want. You can see who the commander is or the senior man in any group. And so for that reason they were picking them out, and they were picking off drivers in passing lorries and tank commanders and so on. So it's very useful.
What are the qualities that make a man a good sniper?
Well, of course, he's got to be able to shoot, and he's got to be extremely accurate. He's also got to be independent. He's got to be an independent soul. He must be resourceful, and he must know when to shoot and when not to shoot. In other words, I think for that sort of work, a strong element of self-preservation is vital. Otherwise, you'll be it'll last no time at all and not do your job. But, I can't think of anything else.
Over what sort of ranges were you taught to snipe when you were up at Lamberis?
Well, actually, on the range, I suppose it was 300 yards was about the maximum. I know we can, the sights said more, but in fact they're about 300 yards. And people were encouraged to go to about 200, fractional shooting. But a lot of the work up in Lamberis was not formal target practice, but shooting at objects on the ground, because there was nothing there. There were no sheep and no civilians. It was all open country. You just shoot at what you wanted.
And that was with the telescopic sight as well? You were shooting at 200
yards? Oh, perhaps a bit more for that, I was thinking, without the telescopic sight. But the people were encouraged to move in. Don't waste your time warning them that you were, warning them that you were there if you weren't going to hit somebody.
So would it be fair to say that stealth and fieldcraft were more important than accuracy?
Yes, yes. And a cool head, because if people were nervous and shaky, they wouldn't shoot straight. And so for that reason, too, they had to be very, very resourceful and independent people.
What sort of country is good for snipers, then? What sort of ground favours their operations?
Well, I suppose not open country. A country which was had a certain amount of cover, moving about, walls, hedges, woods, houses, certainly streets, towns, villages. They can be used anywhere except in wide open plains, moors. But even the moors, the Lovett scout showed us, they could be very useful.
Presumably they were using their stalking skills.
As ghillies. They were all ghillies on the Lovett estates. And Lord Lovett used to come and see us quite regularly. He took a personal interest in this particular court. I think at that time he was a commando, was he not? So he was very good.
Did you find you had a lot of volunteers to go on your sniping courses? Were they?
Oh, they weren't volunteers.
They were just picked, were they?
In the sense you picked up the chaps you thought would be best, probably the NCO types. They were above the normal run of people. They had to be special and they had to be picked, and I used to pick them very carefully as far as I could when I was deciding who should do it, because you were giving them very expensive equipment and there was no point in just they weren't going to use it properly. You wouldn't waste the time with it, and so they were rather special people.
When you were put in charge of sniping, did you carry on as well as a platoon officer, or were you?
Oh yes, oh yes.
So you weren't attached to headquarters as a
sniper
officer?
Oh no, no, no. It was really, if I suppose, looking back, I had the responsibility for them, getting their equipment and so on, and generally training them in this period between before the invasion, and then once they'd been allocated to their battalions, that was my end of it, really. I used to see them out in the field operating pairs and going off, but they were sent out by the intelligence department and so on. I ceased to be concerned at all.
How soon then before the invasion did you know that you were going? How much notice did you get that?
Well, I suppose when we got back to this country from Sicily.
But, when Overlord was actually launched in June, how many days before did you know that it was going to?
Well, we'd moved down, I can't remember the exact times now, but we'd moved down, of course, to Southampton. So it was fairly obvious. We'd done the exercises, Smash 1 and 2. So we'd met our boats. And, of course, we'd seen all the other equipment there. I remember being open-mouthed at some of the equipment that was being assembled. I remember seeing part of Pluto, which looked like an enormous bobbin floating about in Southampton water. We didn't know what that was. We saw pieces of Mulberry, some with cranes, some without. Again, we'd no idea what they were for. We saw the crabs, the scorpions, and the flails, the other tanks that we had. And it was then we obviously we knew we were going very quickly, and you were going very soon, and we were ready to go. We wanted to go. We'd been on leave before we went down to Southampton. I do know that once we went to Southampton, we weren't incarcerated immediately. But very soon afterwards, and the organisation there was magnificent with the tents and things.
Right.
In the woods, everybody were there, the tents and the food and so on. It was good weather then, and so we were lucky.
Do you remember what ship you were embarked on?
It was an LCI. I don't know, it had a number. And a big number painted on the side, but I can't remember. Was it 111, something like that? But they were the LCIs, not the LCTs, that we were on. And they weren't the ordinary assault barges. They were proper landing craft infantry, the kind with a ramp on each side of the prow, port and starboard. And the idea being that they ran the prow into the beach, and the people went down the ramps on each side.
How many of you were there on the particular LCI?
I think the battalion, I think. I mean, it was very full, very crowded. But I know I was one of the first off it when it came to it, my company was. And being equipped at that stage, not only had we our own equipment, but we've got to take a lot of spares. And Ian English had the bicycle company. Everybody had a bicycle in his company. The idea being that he'd rush off down the road as soon as we landed with his men on bicycles. But some of the rest of us, including myself, had a bicycle. I carried a bicycle. I also had a spare battery, which I carried, and some extra Bren gun magazines to generally help out. So that we'd have sufficient equipment when we got to the other side, and I'd know to hand over the magazines to the Bren gunners. We were given a good supply of condoms with which to waterproof things like grenades, because I think all officers had two grenades, but they had to be in condoms to waterproof them, watches, compasses. All went into condoms, separate ones, and and in addition to that, of course, we had a very heavy load to carry, and in addition to that, the final part was the waders, They gave us huge waders, which went over our boots and so on, and right up to under our armpits, over the equipment, over everything. The idea being to, of course, keep us dry when we were ashore. I remember that in common with certainly a number of other officers, probably quite a few of the men, I was in fact wearing my pyjamas underneath my battle dress. The reason being, of course, that prevented chafing if you were required to go for some time. And I think I wore my battle dress for about 28 days before it was changed. So I was pretty filthy and smelly at the end of it. But I had got my pyjamas underneath, and it was very useful. And I think nowadays people wear things like silk stockings and tights, ladies' tights, to keep warm. I think that's right. But we hadn't got those in those days. Do you want me to go on? We went down. Eventually, we went down to the harbour, and it was too rough to go. And
were you embarked when that delay came?
Yes, as far as I remember, we had embarked. I don't think we were taken back to the camp. I think we were embarked, but it was a delay. And then the next day, and I suppose this would be June the 5th, we had a visit from various dignitaries who came to see us off. And I remember that seeing a group of very high power leaders, many of the cabinet members were there, including Churchill, Attlee, Eden, Bevin, Herbert Morrison, Archibald Sinclair. There are also a number of leaders from overseas, Mackenzie King, Prime Minister of Canada, Jan Smuts, Prime Minister of South Africa, Prince Bernard of the Netherlands, and others. And these people, it was quite remarkable, these great people who walked along us and chatted and very friendly, and it was rather nice that they'd come, we thought. And they came to, we saw Churchill again later, and after a few days, but he was there seeing us off and seeing that everything was going well. Being on board, we were then told that in fact we were going to go on our way. Boat sailed. Got out dark, almost dark, or it was dark, I think. It was certainly dark when we went past the Needles, I know that. Because what had happened was that the weather was, from a sea point of view, was not good, in the sense that it was rough, or tended to be roughish. The result was everybody was being sick. I mean, I say everybody, a lot of people were. And we'd been given seasick pills, but they weren't terribly effective. And although I'm a reasonably good sailor, in due course, I started feeling very squeamish myself, queasy. And eventually, in spite of orders, I'm afraid I left my bunk, this metal bed we had, and I went out on deck. And the troops were not allowed to be on deck during this period, but I found myself a small corner on the deck, and I spent the remainder of the night on deck because I wasn't going to land in a seasick position. As a result, I say I saw the Needles in the darkness, and I saw the boats all around because, of course, of their fluorescent wakes. We were going one behind the other, and I think there were three boats in our little group, three LCIs, and we had a tiny minesweeper leading the way in front of us. And there was a lot of aircraft activity. Bombing was going on. They were on the other side. And there was an occasional hooting from the naval vessels. Occasionally MTBs and other boats moved in amongst us. Because actually it was a case of just sailing across the channel. Breakfast was served. I didn't want any breakfast. I'd had enough. You asked me earlier on about feeling tired. I certainly didn't feel tired that night, and I wouldn't have slept if I'd lain down. I knew that, because it was a high adventure, and I think everybody was keyed up for it. My part in the actual disembarkation was to lead the way down the starboard side ramp, the front. And we'd practice this in exactly the same way. I used to take my platoon there, and done it in smash one, smash two. I knew exactly what to expect. Of course, I had a new platoon. I got into my position, and they, for my new platoon formed up behind me, ready to lead the way down this starboard side. In due course, the prow rammed the beach. I should have said that before we came in, the boat started performing a most unusual manoeuvre, in that the LCIs started going around in tight circles, or a tight circle, and they moved towards the beach, circling in that way, and then eventually, when they were within, I suppose, striking distance, they peeled off one at a time, rammed the prows into the beach, and then the next LCI would come next to it and ram in there. On, and it was all worked like a charm. And again, the highest admiration for the American naval personnel involved, all ranks, very good. There were American naval personnel responsible for lowering the ramps. The prow of our boat went into the shingle, and the American sailor lowered the ramp, and I knew that exactly what to do, because I'd done it at smash one and smash two. I was to walk off down the gangway and step onto the beach and get off the beach as quickly as I can, because a lot of shelling was expected. I went down, manfully I hope, as far as the bottom of the ramp was concerned, and I stepped off in exactly the same way that I had done at smash one and smash two, hailing Allen and Studland, and went into, I'm not sure how deep the water was, but it was certainly far deeper than I was. And I went straight to the bottom on my hands and knees, finished on my hands and knees, in the water. It was daylight, of course, by then. But I was aware of the fact that the prow of this LCI kept smashing into the shingle right next to me, and I could see it smashing my legs or arms or me if I got anywhere near it. Of course, I had these waders now full of water, and I couldn't do a thing. And my first act was to get rid of the folding bicycle that I was carrying. I threw that away. I then started to tear at the waders. I managed to tear them off the top. I also unfastened my webbing and slipped that off. And eventually I landed on Hitler's Fortress Europe on my hands and knees, having crawled up the beach, wet through, very frightened, and completely unarmed. And that was the way Jallon landed on the beach. And I've always remembered it, and it's the little thing that you do remember on these occasions. I'd been frightened of people jumping in on top of me, as well as the prow of the boat, because that might have been difficult. But I always remember that the American sailor who'd let the ramp down saw me standing on the beach, and he removed his tin hat and he threw it to me and said, "You need it more than I do." And I've always remembered that little thing. I never wore it, of course, it was police they answered with earphones and things, but I thought it was a very nice gesture in the circumstances. And then from there we went up the beach. I remember that I saw my first frogmen. I had no idea what a frogman was. I'd never heard of frogmen. But they were, in fact, frogmen sitting, resting on the beach. They'd been dealing with the element C. The engineers, presumably, had removed all the wire in the mines. And there was the weighing land lying across the obstructions. And we proceeded to go at them.
Were you actually under heavy shell fire when you crossed
the beach? Quite a lot of shell fire. And it was... I think the doctor was injured there, Dr. Thornton. I think he was one of the first casualties on the beach, I think. But it was... we weren't conscious of bombs or shells dropping all around very much. It was a case of... There's so much pandemonium going on with more people arriving in ships. And by this time, of course, the surprise didn't matter so much, so that people were hooting and the ships were hooting and the tank tracks were rumbling and so on. It was quite...
Was the beach sort of crowded and cluttered?
No, ours wasn't. Not that I remember. There were these people there. I don't think the men of the beach brick had arrived at that stage. There were no piles of supplies lying around or anything like that. It was on a seaside beach. And away up through the town, La Riviere, I think it was called, leading inland and on the way to Bayeux.
Did you see any knocked out tanks on the beach?
No. Not that I remember.
You mentioned shell fire. Were you getting any small arms fire?
No.
At that stage?
Not that I remember.
So, yes, presumably the machine guns had been...
Not dealt with. Oh, yes. If there were any there, I don't know. But I've since been back to Omaha and those places and I've seen the pictures and heard the accounts of what happened there. But we were certainly... did not meet the opposition the Americans met lower down.
Well, the brigade that landed on the western side, 231 Brigade, they had very great difficulty in dealing with Le Hamel, a little town
yes.
on the edge of their area, which was pretty well all blockhouses disguised as seafront buildings. Usual technique was to take the floors out of these buildings, fill them with concrete, and you'd have the skin of a house with a blockhouse inside it. But you say there was nothing in La Riviere, no opposition?
We never saw anything like that. As far as I know, I never wasn't concerned with shooting, any fighting in La Riviere. We were just getting through and getting away from the beach. The emphasis being that we must move and we must get to Bayeux. And nobody wanted to stay on the beach because we all knew that it wouldn't be very long before a German artillery range on it, or very long before German bombers came. And so for that reason, we were expecting a real humdinging do, and I don't think I was alone in wanting to get away from that particular spot as soon as possible. We moved off down the road. Ian went off with his bicycling soldiers and disappeared somewhere, and we went off down the road we were told to go down. We did see at that stage, looking down open fields, because of course harvest time was with us, I do remember seeing a considerable number of German infantry moving across, not through, these fields on our right. We went along this raised road, but they were some distance away and were not presenting any immediate threat to us, and we could do nothing about them. I remember during that occasion a little light-hearted tomfoolery took place when Philip Hampson, Captain Hampson of the carriers, rode along the road on a horse which he'd found, he being a rather keen horseman and owning race horses later, but he made us all laugh by riding bareback on this horse he'd found in a field. But that was an incident then. In due course, we did come across infantry, and these people were Russians. And when we got there in sufficient numbers, I remember they came out of the wherever they'd been with their hands in the air and declaiming the fact that they were Rusky, Rusky. And they weren't to know that the fact they weren't shot immediately was largely, I think, thanks to the senior people there who appreciated that although a lot of the men, our men, regarded them as traitors because they were Russian and should be shot as traitors, I think some of them may have been shot, but I think most of them were saved because the officers and NCOs saw to it that these people were prisoners of war, and that was that. So, but it's, I remember they were the cries of Rusky, Rusky, very well.
Do you remember what sort of positions they were in? Were they in...
They weren't in prepared positions.
They weren't?
No. No, they may have been moving between...